Hey, Anna, I think everybody knows that 12 people walked on the surface of the moon, right? Everybody knows that.
Oh, everybody.
But how many people flew to the moon? How many people have left the surly bonds of Earth's atmosphere and going out into space, into around the moon?
Why wouldn't it be 12?
It's more than 12 because
Shut
they had
up.
Extra missions. Remember, there's Apollo 13, the mission that all they had the mistakes and all the air, the danger. And so they flew around the moon. But there were a couple other missions that flew around the moon but didn't land. So 9 missions made their way around the moon, each with 3 people in it. So how many people went to the moon?
I was not told there would be math.
21.
Now it's...
I know. See, it doesn't make any sense. It should be 27, right?
Yeah, because I can actually do simple math.
Well, so 6 people went twice.
Oh,
isn't that amazing?
That is a trick question. Nobody likes a know-it-all.
Oh, sorry about that. Well,
just saying.
With that intro, from the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, this is Looking Up. I'm Dean Regas.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory, where Dean's the astronomer, and I have a lot of questions. In this episode, we're going to talk with Professor James Hansen, the author of the Neil Armstrong biography that's now being made into a major motion picture. All right, so people went all the way to the moon and then just, like, didn't get out of the car.
No, not quite that much. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, they all flew to the moon in Apollo 11, but there are several other missions, some that came before and some that came after that didn't land. Like Apollo 10, they flew all the way to the moon. So you're getting this giant rocket, the Saturn V rocket that's 360-some feet tall.
Why not Moon 5?
I don't know. That's a really, okay, that's a good, why didn't they call it the Moon 5?
It's like, why are you trying to complicate
never
things?
Never had anybody ask that question before. Yet that's so brilliant. That's really good.
Exactly.
Well, the Saturn, the ill-named Saturn V, that is pretty ridiculous.
Like,
now I'm not going to get over this.
Like, how could you mess this up? It's just like very simple. It's moon. You're going to the moon.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Oh,
but
well.
Fine.
The Saturn V rocket.
Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, it's 360-something feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
You climb into this thing, and you're at the very top of this rocket, and you travel out into space going over, 240,000 miles all the way to the moon.
Uh-huh.
And Apollo 10 went all the way to the moon.
Yeah.
They detached the moon lander from the spacecraft, and they went down, down, down towards the moon, these two guys, and they made it
like
within...
Like got out of the space?
No, they were in...
But the whole craft did.
Yes, they're in the lander, and they went down within 10 miles of the surface of the moon, and then they went back up, rendezvoused with the orbiting craft, and then went all the way back home. So they came within 10 miles of hitting the surface of the moon, and that was the precursor to Neil Armstrong going all the way down the moon. Can you imagine those people that went all the way within 10 miles of touching the surface?
No.
I know.
The next time somebody tells me something's anticlimactic, I'm going to tell them that story.
That's
I'll be like, you know
story.
What anticlimactic is?
Yes.
You make all that way to go to the moon.
That's right.
And then it's like, I don't know.
Now,
just
the other
peace
thing,
out.
So we're going to be talking to James Hansen about Neil Armstrong, and there's a lot of psychology to these astronauts. And they were really, in some cases, they were worried that those astronauts were going to go rogue and be like, hey, we're 10 miles from the surface. Oh, whoops, there's a faulty thing, a wire. We landed. Oh, my gosh, the Eagle has landed. Sorry, Neil Armstrong, we got there first. They really were afraid that they could do that.
When you said psychology, do you mean ego?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is going to be, we're going to get, I can't wait. This is, I really can't wait to hear what Professor Hansen says about Neil Armstrong.
Oh,
I want to get the dirt. I want to know what was like, what his personality was like.
And I think he's probably very humble.
Yeah,
he seems
I think
like
so.
He was just like, did his job.
Yes.
But like, did it awesomely and in a pioneering fashion.
Yeah, but I mean, it could have been very easily somebody else that landed. And so it's that, Apollo 10 mission and then some of the other missions that went to the moon but didn't land, like Apollo 8.
Mm-hmm.
They went around the moon and got to see the whole Earth for the first time.
So was there 1 through 10? And then 11 just like, lucky that, number 11.
Well, that's where it gets kind of confusing because...
More confusing than Saturn V?
Well, there was a 1, okay. But that one tragically ended in a fire on the launch pad.
Oh, God.
And so then it got confusing because they skipped some in there. And I don't know why. Again, okay. Not smart with the naming of things.
Yeah.
So some didn't go and some only went around Earth. Some went to the moon and some they skipped.
You know, it's funny, though. They didn't skip 13.
No.
You know, there's not a 13th row on an airplane because people are superstitious and stuff. And there's like a 13th floor at a hotel. But they're going to go ahead and have a 13th Apollo mission. That seems like they were... I don't want to say they were asking for trouble.
I know.
Come on.
Well, whenever I sit in the 14th row, I'm like, man, it's the 13th row.
You're like, can I be moved, please?
I'm superstitious and observant.
I know what you're doing.
I know what you're trying to do. It's not working.
Oh, man. Yikes. Well, but I mean, I think that I could definitely see them being like, we're so close. Whoops, I slipped. I'm just going to tumble right out. And
exactly.
Now, is that bad?
Like, there's no way they could have stopped them. I mean, they were testing every single system. It was a huge deal. When we send people up to the space station, that's tough. But going all the way to the moon, because you launch up into Earth orbit. So you circle around the Earth for several times. Then you hit the afterburners and you go to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes you 3 days to go from the Earth to the moon. And getting your trajectory just right to make sure you get that spot. And then you start circling around the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Then one guy stays up circling around the moon while two guys drop down in a lander. And the other guy's by himself circling around the moon all by himself while the other two people go down and walk around on the moon.
Yeah.
And then they have to launch off of the moon, up and rendezvous with the guy circling around the moon. And then they have to go 3 days back to get to Earth and splash down the Pacific Ocean. And so for those folks that went almost all the way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, then you think about how, I mean, to the kind of back to the book here with, you know, how famous Neil Armstrong is. I mean, he was the first. I mean, he is like, everyone knows who Neil Armstrong is.
Right, right.
It could have been like somebody else.
It could have been somebody else. It could have been anybody.
Crazy.
And so that's what I really want to ask Professor Hansen about this is, you know, how he handled this fame. And it was kind of unique. I mean, he was this humble guy.
Yeah.
I mean, if I try to put myself in that place, what would you do if you were the first person on the moon? I mean, and you're now the most famous person in the whole world.
I would have such a great Instagram. Yeah. I have like millions of followers.
So
I mean,
you would embrace the celebrity.
I think we all know I would embrace the celebrity team.
Would. There's no doubt about that.
Please. Really? It would be great.
I mean, would you use it for your financial gain? Again, yes, is the answer.
Probably. Most likely.
Oh, that was
sweet.
Is that an option? That was sweet that you paused there.
I was like, no, no. And then I was like, wait a minute.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was not a genuine pause. That was total.
It's going to clear my throat.
It's total acting.
That's right.
Fake. I don't know.
What would you do?
Well, see, because Neil turned into such seemingly recluse. I mean, that he was not taking interviews. He was, but it's hard to tell what you would do when you're walking down the street and everybody knows who you are and everybody wants a piece of you and everybody has stories about, you know, how I met him one day. And I mean, it's hard to believe that you know, the one of the most famous people was somebody that's went to space.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, saying like he's reclusive, I almost think he was maybe just like private and was like, you know what? I'm good. Like, I did this thing and it's exciting, but now I'm like, okay.
Right.
Back to life. I don't know.
Well, so what I never got was, I mean, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, they both went on the same rocket. They both went to the moon. They both landed at the same time. So they're both there. Why? Just because Neil stepped out the ladder first and stepped on the, why does that make him like...
Yeah.
100 times more popular than Buzz Aldrin.
And what if like Buzz was like, no, you go first. Then he was like, okay. And then it's like, oh,
I shouldn't have let him.
But I mean, Armstrong had such a great quote too.
Well, there we go. Right. Yeah.
I mean, that was like, I don't know what Buzz was going to say, like, but I don't know.
I know.
Neil Armstrong really like, that was iconic.
One obviously. Small step for a man,
right.
One giant leap for mankind. Now, of course, there's the debate of what did he say? What did he really say? Did he mess up the line? Was it one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind? Did he not say one small step for a man?
I thought it was just man. Is it a man?
Well, it should be a man. Is the right way. And so they go back and forth. Mm. Did he say a? Did he not say a? Was it?
Was it rehearsed?
Was it not rehearsed? It's one of those mysteries that'll kind of go on. But it was so good. And then the story, the line, the eagle has landed. That's the landing craft when it landed. And
people say that all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, those were the big moments of that generation. And to think we haven't been back to the moon in 45 years. And
I don't understand. Now it should be like easy. Like, I can't imagine being able to do it then. And I was like, we're just going to leave. And we've seen it. We're good. It's like... Just wanted to do it one time.
It was a big product of the time, that's for sure. I mean, this is the space race was going on. We had to get to the moon before the Soviet Union
put our flag down.
Put our flag there.
It's ours now.
And I mean that was a debatable thing too. Why put the flag down? Isn't that really colonizing? Isn't that saying, yep, this is ours?
That's the most American thing I've ever heard of. Well, we landed here first. We're just going to put our flag on it. It's ours.
I know. Out of what symbol?
It's great.
But then kind of lost in that, they brought this plaque that they put up there. They say, we came for peace. We came for all humankind and that kind of thing.
That's nice.
The flag is the one that's standing there.
But they didn't bring humankind's flag.
No.
They brought the American flag.
I know. Why didn't they bring the United Nations flag or something like that? And it was debated. NASA really debated this. Every little bit of this, the moon landing, was so planned out. Everything was so what people said, when they said it, what they brought with them. It was all checklist and back and forth. And but there's so many of these hidden stories. So I can't wait to talk to Professor Hansen because I want to.
Are you trying to bust this wide open or something? You seem very I'm going to get to the heart of it.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. I think it's Neil Armstrong was a simple man who just accomplished a huge thing.
Yes.
But you're ready to get into it.
No, I want to know the true Neil Armstrong. That's what he's this man of mystery. I don't know what it's like. I think it probably adds to it that feels a little less well known. So,
yeah.
Well, let's get to it.
I can't wait.
Yeah. So as you can tell, we are really excited to welcome the author of what's been called the definitive biography of astronaut Neil Armstrong. It's called First Man. And we've got the professor of history and the director of the University College at Auburn University himself, James Hansen. James, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, so we want to dive right into it. And so the summer of 1969... Neil Armstrong, became not only the first man to walk on the moon, but maybe the most famous person on the planet. Why do you think those things went hand in hand?
Well, the first part of it was something Neil was had planned for a long time and was very happy about. The mission came off as successfully as it did. The second part about becoming world famous and a celebrity in that was, as people in the Cincinnati area probably know, wasn't part of his plan and wasn't something that he really enjoyed very much. He tried his best and was after the Apollo 11 mission to lead as normal a life as possible. But for the first man on the moon, it wasn't something that was easy to do.
Well, so there's this one quote that you have early on the book, and I'm just going to read this. It says, when you're talking about astronauts, you say, you get a feeling that people think that these men they're not just superior men, but maybe even different creatures. They're like people who have gone into the other world and returned. Why do you think astronauts have this mystique about them?
Well, I think it is because they've experienced something that is that a very, very small fraction of the human population has ever done, and that for centuries and centuries seemed fantastical and was the stuff of science fiction. I think we probably are a little less affected by astronauts today. The space shuttle era, the astronaut experience became something quite a bit different than the early astronauts, and the crews were much larger, and the missions were seemingly less novel, although they were still actually, and they still were tremendously exciting for people that followed space exploration. But I just think if it was something, you know, to go to another world, to go to our moon and step out on it. And, of course, we did it a total of 6 times successfully. Neil and Buzz and Mike Collins were first to do it. And plus, I think part of it was it was what we projected onto them. And certainly the astronauts themselves didn't care for that sort of iconography, that sort of hero worship or otherworldliness. I mean, they were all normal people in most every respect, except for the fact that people felt that they were different. And I do think to some extent, you know, NASA and the media, you know, that it helped to sell the program to have the astronauts come off in this kind of way as being, you know, some almost superhuman. But, you know, when you talk, and I've interviewed most all of the early astronauts at one point or another in my career, and they, you know, they always resist the notion that there's something really special about them. I mean, they were special in the sense that most of them had great engineering backgrounds. Many of them had military careers. Many of them were test pilots. And that put them in a pretty special class of people, but they didn't feel like they were otherworldly or deserved the kind of special attention that society gave them.
So, kind of along that vein, Neil Armstrong was notoriously humble and unassuming, and maybe shy even, and not many people really maybe got to know him for as famous as he was. In all your interviews, did you feel like you kind of found the true Neil Armstrong, or the essence of the true Neil Armstrong?
Well, I think I got about as close to it as you can get. I mean, I think, you know, with all of us, there's elements of our personality and who we are that maybe escape even close family members and friends. And I think Neil's personality was just a little more ineffable than most. I mean, I think he was very introspective. There was a shyness about him. He kept a lot of things. He kept a lot of his thoughts seemingly to himself. You know, but at the same time, he could be quite outgoing. He had a great wry sense of humor. He could be very sociable in the right situations. Mm. So, I mean, I think the only way I've sometimes said this on when I've given talks about Neil, I think the only way I could have gotten any deeper into who he was is if I had him on the psychiatrist's couch for,
yeah,
for hundreds of hours. But that's not a place you were ever going to get Neil. I think my book comes. I tried to keep it as true to who he was as I could really judge. I mean, one thing I didn't want to do. So many people in his life and certainly media projected meanings onto him. For example, calling him reclusive. And I think they called him reclusive because he refused to do interviews with them.
Right. So, right. Sure, of course. Reclusive.
And he did a lot of things. He gave lots of talks. And from his own point of view, he felt like, well, what more can I really do and still have any normal semblance of life? But, you know, as characters go, I mean, I think we all, where there's an element of not necessarily mystery, but of, you know, just a little bit, something's just a little bit private, and you're not really sure whether you can ever get to that or not. And I think Neil's personality type was such, it's just, you know, just a little harder to figure out. And I think you have to sort of let the events of his life and the expressions of his life kind of wash over you for a long period of time, and then get almost an intuitive sense of what kind of person this was. And I got to know him well enough but still tried to stay objective as a scholar and a biographer, to be able to, you know, look analytically at certain aspects of his life and his personality as well.
Well, and it was very detailed. I mean, he talked to so many people in his life, and there's one quote that was from his high school yearbook, and the quote under his picture said, "He thinks, he acts, it's done." What do you think that was? That like his credo, or is that what other people observed about him?
Well, I think that's what other people thought, and I think there's a certain strong truth to that. On the other hand, on the other hand, I think there are people that I talked to for the book, including his first wife, Janet Armstrong, and others as well, as quick as he could be, you know, say in a cockpit of an airplane or a spacecraft in terms of making decisions, he could be extremely slow and deliberate about making other decisions in life. And to the point that it could frustrate, you know, I know it frustrated his wife, it sort of frustrated his children, it frustrated friends. And I experienced that myself. From the first time I contacted him about doing the book to the time we had a written agreement between the two of us, it took about 2 years.
Oh, wow.
To do that. Wow. And I could write a book just about how that all happened.
Yeah, he seems very reflective, like he wanted to get things right, you know, that he wanted to say it correctly. But it is weird because, you know, on the other hand, and he's a fighter pilot that has to make decisions right away.
Yeah, and he could make some of those decisions were surprising. One of the maybe more surprising stories, when he was a combat pilot in Korea, he told me this story after the book came out, actually. I don't think he wanted it in the book per se, although after I heard it, I told him, I'm going to have to get into a later edition, which I've done. But he was flying one of the 70 combat missions over Korea in 1951, and he was in a scouting mission over North Korea, and he came in his jet plane over this ridge, and down below was a large group of North Korean troops in formation doing their morning calisthenics. And it would have been, so his decision was, you know, flip the lid on the machine gun and just start, you know, mowing them down with his machine gun from his airplane. And that was a decision that probably most naval aviators in that situation would have taken. Neil's split decision was, I think they're having a hard enough time this morning on their own.
There we go.
He just reported what he saw and kept flying. And I talked to the other members of his fighter squadron who were still alive, and I asked them, you know, would any of them have done the same thing? And they, to a person, said, we would have unloaded on him.
You know? Wow.
But Neil, for whatever reason, whether it was a certain element of his humanity or you know, he wanted some kind of fairness in what he was doing, even though he's, you know, he did a, you know, what basically what those planes had to do over North Korea was bomb railroad lines and anti-artillery installations and different things. But, you know, and that Neil, you know, did as a soldier that he was. But it just wasn't in him to just open up on a bunch of unarmed troops or out doing jumping jacks. That took an instant decision that he, you know, if he had deliberated on that for a long period of time, I'm not sure his decision would have been any different. But it's an interesting, you know, anecdote sort of showing how these split decisions can be life or death sometimes.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really exciting that the book is being made into a movie that's coming out. I think it's October. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. We're done shooting and they're busy. Damien Chazelle, the director, is busy editing now, and we're hoping for, the plan is for it to come out in mid-October. Ryan Gosling is playing Neil, and I was a co-producer on the project, and so I was at almost every day of the shoot. And
both of us want to know how Ryan Gosling is and how we can meet him.
That's right. I want to know more than Dean wants to know. But
that's actually true. I was just humoring her. But
I can tell you, I think the world of him. I wasn't sure what I would find, but he was tremendously generous with me and interested. He really was interested in hearing everything I had to say about Neil, learning as much as he could. He actually, I arranged for him to go up to Wapakoneta, not only to tour the museum, but he went out to the farmhouse outside of town where Neil was born and where Neil's sister June spends the time in the farmhouse. And so Ryan and Damien Chazelle spent the whole afternoon one day in the midsummer sitting and talking with June and with one of Neil's boyhood friends from First Sandusky, Ohio. And so they got they really researched this. I mean, there wasn't anything about Neil and his life and everything surrounding that they weren't interested in. And of course, it's a movie, and so you can't, it's not a documentary. So, you know, people shouldn't expect, you know, 100% factual accuracy, but, you know, it's my job, you know, at least as I define my job at the movie shoot, to try to keep things as authentic as possible. And I think Ryan, in particular, has done an incredible job. And I think he, you know, you're not going to get a photograph. I mean, the way I think of it myself, it's not a photograph of Neil that's being done. It's a portrayal. It's a portrait. And so there's an element of interpretation of the character that you have to leave to the actor and to the director. And it gets built into the drama of the story itself that's being told. But I think there's some fundamental truths, not only about Neil, but about the whole era and about the moon landing, that is going to come through in this movie in ways that have not come through before. So I think people are going to be surprised to some extent because it's not another Apollo 13. It's certainly not another Right Stuff. It's going to have a very different tone and approach to it. And I think it's going to be really exciting and eye opening to people.
Well, if it has one-tenth of what you have in your book, First Man, I think it's just a great insight on a American hero. So thanks so much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Well, I hope I'm strongly suggesting to Universal Pictures that they do a major premiere.
I think that would be great.
Gosh.
And again, Ryan Gosling, if he's here,
we'll get Ryan there.
Oh, yeah. Well, can't wait to see it. All right. Thanks,
well, you're
James.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for chatting.
Well, the Cincinnati Observatory has been around since the mid-1800s, so you can only imagine the many letters and emails and whatever we've received in that time, that some of which have some very interesting questions or beliefs. And today, with this episode that we're talking a lot about the moon and Neil Armstrong, we have to go with the ultimate crank file question.
This is it, yeah, because all the questions we put in this file called the crank file,
right.
And these are the outlandish conspiracies, all the theories mm-hmm. out there, and so the granddaddy of them all, did we in fact land on the surface of the moon? Did we put 12 people on the moon
right.
and to bring them back,
mm-hmm.
or was it all staged in Hollywood, California on a soundstage? What do you think, Anna?
What if I was like, I think it's completely staged? Would you freak out?
I would freak out.
Oh, my gosh.
Out.
I should have planned that better.
Are you crazy?
No, well, I'm sure it happened.
Now, so the people that claim, all right, we faked this was, well, number mm-hmm. one, could we in 1969 send people to the moon? They say that would be ridiculous. I mean, like we said, we can't even go back to the moon in 2000. I forgot what year
what
it was.
What year do you
think? I was going to say 1970.
What decade do you think? What century? Okay.
2018, right. It's 18, right? I forget what year it is sometimes.
That's cool.
So if we can't do it now, how could we have done it then? Then they also show photographs of how, if they were really on the moon, would the lights be the way they would be? Like that they show shadows that are like not parallel. So the sun would be the only source of light. And so they thought, well, these pictures had to be staged on because the sun wouldn't make shadows the way it does.
Okay.
They have all this other things about, well, they could fake the gravity. They could, why weren't there stars in the background when you took pictures? All of these are completely explainable and completely, you can demonstrate them very easily.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you want to take a picture of stars, take your camera phone, try to get a picture of yourself and with stars behind you, see if you can get that picture.
Myself, like a selfie with stars.
Yes, and you have your picture, your face, and the stars behind you.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the correct answer is you can't do that.
Oh, geez.
Because the camera can't
focus. Is it
focus.
Because you have a flip phone?
Yeah, it's mostly because I have a flip phone. That's true. I said your phone, which is
very
high tech.
Absolutely.
Yes. You can't. The camera will focus on you. It'll mm-hmm. light up your face, but not the stars behind you because the stars are so faint, you can't get them.
Yeah.
But the big claim to fame is they say, okay, if any one picture was faked, if NASA faked any little bit of it, that means we did not go to the moon. Now I flip it around to him. Mm. I give him the old switcheroo. Oh, and I say, wait, the reverse is more accurate, is that you have to prove that every single picture is faked, that every single video is fake, that every piece of evidence is fake. Because if one of them is true, then we did go to the moon.
Yeah, the burden of proof is on them.
Oh, yeah, I know. That they usually like that. They get really mad. They're just like, whoa. And so the one piece of proof that you cannot fake, even in today's technology, is the gravity. When they go to the moon, you weigh 1/6 of what you weigh on Earth. And so the conspiracy theorists would say, well, they slowed down the footage. They slowed down the picture so it looked like they're moving slower. Okay. Doesn't work that way. And so if you ever see one of the videos that where one of the astronauts does a jump, he jumps up at normal speed, but then falls back with 1/6 gravity.
Oh.
So up and then back.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, oh, well, they could have put a string on him. But if you look carefully, I don't know. I'm just thinking
of
like bungee cord or something.
Right.
And but you can watch him jump up, but you could also watch any piece of dust, any kind of moon rock that they kick. It goes up normal speed, falls down at 1/6 gravity. And that cannot be faked. In fact, when we look at movies today, they can't even fake it. Like, they can't fake other gravities on other planets. I know.
Game changer.
Yep. So did I convince you we went to the moon?
Okay. Let me just, for the listeners, I know we went to the moon. I was just playing maybe doubted it. So I'd get y'all on your high horse about how you really went there.
Yes.
Have you ever convinced anybody that they were Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs?
I actually show them that video. The best video is one of the astronauts falling over.
Mm-hmm.
And you think,
fall like a blooper?
Yeah, yeah. It's a total blooper. He's stumbling on the moon He's wearing this giant backpack with the suit that on Earth would weigh hundreds of pounds, but on the moon doesn't weigh very much, but it throws his balance off. He falls down.
Oh, man.
All this dust and stuff gets kicked up. And you watch it and you're like, they couldn't put strings on each piece of dust. They couldn't have stopped. It's just not fakeable. And then it does convince people, especially when I say, oh, well, look at that movie, The Martian, with Matt Damon.
Mm-hmm.
He was on Mars. They have 1/3 gravity. They couldn't even fake it in 2016. Yeah. So what do you think they do in 1969?
Oh, my gosh. Just went there, and it was real.
They went there. Perfect. Whew. I convinced you.
Yes
another success.
We're going to get letters now.
I know. She already knew we
That's
went
right,
to the moon.
It's fine. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a fun time. That's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks again to James Hansen, author of First Man, for joining us. Get in touch with us. We want to hear from you. We are on Facebook. Just search Looking Up. And we're also on Twitter at Looking Up Podcast. You can also drop us a note at lookingup@wvxu.org.
Ask us a question, give us a topic suggestion, or ask your kids what they'd like to ask an astronomer or scientist, and we'll answer them on future episodes.
And remember to subscribe to Looking Up on iTunes and rate us there, or on Stitcher, or on wvxu.org/lookingup. Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y ? From their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.